Hi, this is Scott. I really appreciate our sponsors because they make the show possible. Today's show is sponsored by Telerik. Create compelling app experiences across any screen with the Telerik platform. Telerik's end-to-end platform uniquely combines industry-leading UI tools with cloud services to simplify the entire app development cycle. Telerik offers everything .NET developers need to build quality apps faster. Try it free at telerik.com/platform. That's telerik.com/platform.
From HanselMinutes.com, it's Hansel Minutes, a weekly discussion with web developer and technologist Scott Hanselman. This is Lawrence Ryan announcing show number 435. In this episode, Scott talks with Cal Ahmed about his .NET-based NoSQL solution called BrightStarDB.
Hi, this is Scott Hanselman. This is another episode of Hansel Minutes, and I'm talking with Cal Ahmed from the BrightStarDB project. Hey, how are you, sir?
I'm fine. How are you doing?
Brilliant, brilliant. Thank you for chatting with me today. So BrightStarDB at brightstardb.com is a embeddable, scalable NoSQL database, and it's for the .NET platform. NoSQL has been a hot term for a couple of years now. But embedded in the term NoSQL is almost an impugning of SQL as a concept. Like, what is this, the exact opposite of a SQL database?
No, not really. I don't think the exact opposite. We still try to adhere to the basic tenets of ACID compliance. So we still look to make sure that we have atomic and consistent and durable transactions. So we still actually have the data storage guarantees of a SQL database. What we've really kind of wanted to give away is the necessity to define your schema up front.
Ah, okay. So when someone says NoSQL, they're really saying no schema, that kind of oppressiveness of a SQL database. Like the schema, there's value in that. It's almost like strong typing versus dynamic typing in languages, isn't it?
For us, yes, but I think you'll find that as you look across the NoSQL space, that NoSQL means different things to different folk. So you'll find that there are NoSQL databases that do require some sort of predefined schema, but they may give up on some of the ACID compliance constraints in order to provide you with better performance or better scalability.
Ah, okay. So if NoSQL means different things to different people, it isn't really fair for someone to say, I'm in the market for a NoSQL database, because that almost doesn't say enough.
Exactly, yes. I mean, when you're looking around at the NoSQL space, what you really should be comparing the different offerings on is, how do they meet my particular application's requirements? And I think this is another key thing, is that you can't really think of I know SQL, now I'm going to go out and learn NoSQL, and I'm going to be able to apply it to all of my projects equally, because the different offerings out there will give you different benefits and different constraints for the different kinds of projects that you work on. So maybe you're looking for pushing through high volumes of transactions, of write transactions, you'll go down one choice. Maybe you're looking for really fast query speeds and being able to custom define your index strategies, then you'll go down a different route. So you know, there really is a huge amount of choice, and I think that's also one of the things that you find in the NoSQL community, is that people are building now data storage solutions that fit a particular profile of application.
Ah, interesting. So if we think about SQL from the Microsoft person's perspective, there's SQL Server, and all flavors and all kinds of applications are created on top of that. But there is still just, SQL Server. Now, you can certainly design a system that has one table and does everything on one giant table. Or you could have big enterprise ones I think we've all been inflicted by SQL Server databases that have hundreds or thousands of tiny tables. But ultimately, it's still SQL Server. It has the behavior characteristics of SQL Server. You're saying that I might do three or four different projects and decide on a NoSQL database, but might find that one NoSQL database is great for the profile and the behavior characteristics required of like a shopping cart, while another one might be appropriate for a cache, or another one might be appropriate for a product database.
Exactly. Yeah.
Interesting. So I can, I have a lot more flexibility in the NoSQL world just because there's so many more specialized databases available to me.
That's right. I mean, so it can be a little bit of a headache because you really need to, you know, educate yourself about all of the different options that are out there, or you may find it difficult to sort of zoom in on the particular product that's going to meet your application profile requirements. You've got to think, you know, ahead a step, where, you know, perhaps in the more traditional approach, you'll say, okay, well, we've got SQL now, what's the problem?
Okay. So if I am thinking to myself that the solution to a problem that I have is a NoSQL database like Brightstar DB, what else do I need to be thinking about other than the term NoSQL? Like, what problem space would lead me to your database?
So I think there, you know, again, across the space, there are probably different hotspots or different problem areas that you're looking at in your particular application that might draw you one way or another in terms of which NoSQL database you go for. Mm-hmm. Our main sort of selling point, if you like, is flexibility. It's the ability to essentially have a schema-free environment, mm-hmm. one where you can simply add data of pretty much any shape. And I think that the other key benefit that we have is that underneath it all, we've actually built on top of W3C's RDF data model standard. So you're actually storing your data as an RDF graph. We actually implement some of the RDF interchange standards and the query standards. So if you're kind of familiar with that world, or if you want to learn about that world, and you're a .NET developer, I think Brightstar DB is a great way into the whole RDF semantic web sort of area.
Okay, so RDF is Resource Description Framework, and if I remember correctly, it's been around for quite a long, long time, but it got the 1.1 specification was published just this year.
That's right, yeah. So it's been around since right at the end of the 90s, I think 99 is when the 1.0 spec came out. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of been there and been bubbling under and you know, people have been using it in research applications and so on for a while. But I think over the past sort of maybe 1 or 2 years, as the whole move towards publishing data online has really grown in popularity, RDF provides that, you know, W3C defined standard for interchange of data of all kinds of shapes. Mm-hmm. So it really does fulfill, you know, a particular need in the data publishing area. But it does it with such a general model that you can actually apply it to, you know, much smaller problem spaces and get some of the benefits of having that very flexible data model.
Why did it see such a resurgence? I mean, when I see examples of RDF descriptions of like people, it reminds me of XML type thinking with like namespaces, and they'll say w3c.org/2000. You know, this is a 15, 20 year old thing, but it suddenly got this resurgence just in the last year because people are excited about REST and the semantic web.
People are excited about, maybe they won't say semantic web. Semantic web has kind of got a lot of baggage with it from many years past. But people are excited about publishing data in a way where they can interchange data and where they can link data sets together. So, for example, you might be aware of DBpedia, which is the project that essentially scrapes all of the info box information from the Wikipedia site and formats it up as a huge RDF data set that is publicly available, that you can use very simple RESTful API calls to go and grab information about any subject that has got a Wikipedia page. Okay. And that data comes back to you in RDF format.
So when people create applications, like I've seen a number of Windows 8 applications that are front ends on top of Wikipedia, they're very likely scraping that from Wikipedia itself, which lends itself to be scraped just because of the regularity of the display. But you're saying DBpedia is an RDF representation of what's inside of Wikipedia. That would be the more appropriate thing for me to pull from.
Exactly, yes. And because they are then using these minted persistent identifiers for the things that they talk about, it means that you can then publish your own data set that has some additional information maybe about these subjects, and you can hook, essentially merge your data with the DBpedia data and get a consistent view across all of that information. So this kind of information integration, building a web of data where everything is loosely linked in the same way that web pages are loosely linked. You know, one data set may refer to another data set. These things don't have to ever know about each other. So it is just a very loose, a loosely coupled graph of data that's spread out all across the web.
When we see examples of these data sets and RDF data sets, they always seem to have classes like country or album, director, you know, things, but there's usually like a top 10 or top 20 things, game, book, movie, politician. But that's not something that's specific to RDF, right? Those are just example things?
Exactly, yeah. So RDF doesn't predefine any of these sort of types at all. So it is totally free to the application developers or the data developers to define their own classes and to define how those classes may be equivalent or different to other classes that other people have defined. Mm-hmm. So there is a huge amount of freedom, essentially, to say whatever you want to say in the way that you want to say it, just as HTML gives us exactly that freedom with, you know, the text and the images that we want to convey to humans. RDF gives us that freedom with the data that we want to convey to machines or to applications.
Okay, so RDF isn't a serialization format as it is an example of an expression of what a graph of data can look like in memory. And then there are different serialization formats that one could take their RDF and express it as?
Absolutely, yes. Yeah. So it is a data model. Really. So it defines a graph-like data model. And then on top of the RDF base, a whole bunch of other, there's a whole stack of standards that go up and give you things like being able to define how your types exist in your data and how they're related to types and properties, you know, how they're related. There's a query language, then there's all kinds of interchange syntaxes as well.
Okay. So important for myself and the listeners to remember or think about that a data model and the description of a data model doesn't necessarily describe what those bytes look like on disk. And that's kind of an obvious thing to say in retrospect, but also maybe not obvious when someone is used to answering questions by simply opening something up in Notepad and saying, oh, look, there's the RDF. You can't really do that with this.
Yeah, absolutely.
So then what are things like, I hear N triples and I hear turtle. What are these terms?
So these are different syntaxes for representing RDF data. So N triples is a very simple, easy to parse, line-oriented format. Mm-hmm. The RDF, at the core of the RDF data model is this idea of a triple, which is simply a statement of subject, predicate, object. So it's the thing you want to talk about, the property that you want to assign a value for, and then the value for that property. Mm-hmm. That triple is serialized, you know, one per line in N triple format. It's really easy to read. It's really easy to parse. It's really easy to generate. Mm-hmm. And then turtle takes the basics of N triples and then actually adds a bunch of features that makes it a lot more compact and easier to write as a human being. It's easier to, you know, when you're communicating with somebody about some problem that you've got with your RDF data, you can hack up an example in Turtle to show them, hey, look, this is what, you know, what I want it to look like, or this is the result that I'm getting. And it's easier for humans to grok, and it's a bit more compact than N triples.
Okay. Okay. So then BrightStarDB is an implementation of the W3C's data model, which is RDF. And then your system says that it has a triple store.
Right. Yeah.
So how do you represent your data, like on disk, and how do you think about your data?
So we think of our data as a collection of if you like, two levels of partition. So the high level partition is a store, and that's like a physical partition. So that's an individual directory that contains some data files that contain all of our indexes and so on. Then within a store, you have a collection of RDF graphs. And so each graph is like a set of triples, and it's a bounded named set of triples. And when you go into query, you can either query one particular graph or some combination of graphs or all the graphs together. So that's our basic, you know, that's our kind of, if you like, logical partitioning of the data. Mm-hmm. And then when we get down to actually on disk, what we're storing is the basic indexing into those sets of triples. So we're storing B-tree indexes that get you down through the triple structure to help you find, to find the particular object for a given subject and predicate, or vice versa, and then obviously to map those to map the identifiers that we have to the actual values.
Mm-hmm. You said bounded name. What does that mean?
As you already mentioned, everything in RDF uses URIs, so it uses the uniform resource identifier schemes for identifying the thing that you want to talk about. So a subject always has a URI, and the predicate is always defined by a URI. And then the value can either be another URI, or it can be a string or an integer or something like that.
Ah, I see.
But the graph is essentially another thing that also has a URI, and it's just a context for all of the statements. So, for example, if I'm collecting information, let's say, about movies, I might have one graph that has all of the movies that are released in 2014, and then another graph that is all of the movies that were released in 2013, and maybe create a graph per year as a logical partition. And that enables me to, you know, very quickly just give you current movies, or very quickly give you the set of movies over a particular range just by selecting which graphs I want to query against.
So forgive my ignorance. I'm going to try to draw a parallel here, and you can tell me if it's a dumb question. In a previous life, when I worked on my blog system called DOSBlog with Clemens Vasters and a team, this is around 2002, it stores all of the blog entries in XML files. And so it is a poor man's database. There's no back-end database. There's simply each day that someone blogged has a file. So if I blog on July 3rd, then there's a July 3rd, 2014 file. And if I blogged 10 times on July 3rd, then there's 10 items in that one file. So the maximum number of XML files that I can end up with in a year is 365. This means that DOSBlog is, even now, 10 years later, ridiculously fast when someone is accessing the data on a daily basis by, you know, giving me all the blog posts for a day. And why it stands up from a scalability perspective against pretty much any blogging system out there. But if I wanted to ask DOSBlog a question that goes across my data partition, for lack of a better phrase, like show me all of the blog posts in this category, it falls over quite quickly, because you can imagine I'm running through thousands and thousands of XML files trying to ask a question that the data just isn't laid out on disk correctly. Does that make sense?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And I think there's, you know, it's a similar kind of trade-off when you're defining graphs in RDF. You have that sort of trade-off of wanting to have partitions that are, you know, small and maybe more responsive, but at the same time that you don't want to get to the point of having so many that when you need to do something across all of them, you have a headache.
Mm-hmm.
So of course, you know, one of the nice things about having a very flexible data model where we have all of these separate contexts is that there is absolutely no reason why you can't say, oh, hey, why don't I just create another graph that is the monthly roll-up? And it just has an abstract of what's in all of these other daily graphs.
Mm-hmm.
And from the monthly ones, why don't I generate an annual roll-up as well that has just some subset of the monthly roll-ups? So there's all kinds of clever ways in which you can structure the graphs, and graphs can be, you know, connected to other graphs as well. You can build some pretty pretty cool kind of data partitioning strategies using graphs and the metadata for graphs.
So does that mean that there are things that I could potentially ask the system that it would not be readily able to answer, or does it just mean it would be slightly slower if the shape of the data isn't in a way that is queryable in a way that I was maybe am I stretching to ask it questions like this?
No, not well. As with all data systems, there are things which is questions that it's good at answering and questions that it will have to think about. Mm. We're still kind of early on in the development of Brightstar, and we know there are kinds of queries that we definitely need to optimize. Mm-hmm. But I think with Brightstar, I mean, one of the things is when I'm talking about all of these graphs, that they're a logical partitioning. So they're breaking down the data into smaller chunks. Mm-hmm. But at a physical data storage level, in fact, they're all going into the same set of indexes.
Mm.
So we're actually able to, you know, query across of these graphs, in parallel. Just using the same set of data files. So it's at the physical partition level where you decide that I maybe want to split my data across multiple stores, mm-hmm. that you will then hit these problems of, well, actually, I can't write a query at the moment that goes across all the stores, though that is actually one of the things that we would like to address as well. Mm-hmm. So.
And if the size of my data is greater than the memory that I have, Brightstar will do the right thing and act appropriately. And it'll keep, I assume it has some in-memory indexes. And then when it can't find something easily, it needs to go and chew for a little while.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, we just implement persistent B trees. So we'll have, you know, the, cached B tree pages, that we manage. And we use that B-tree structure as well. At the moment, the way we've got it is we're just actually using that B-tree structure as the way that we handle the queries as well. So, it will absolutely do the right thing. We want it to work on constrained memory devices. So we want it to work on your tablet, and we want it to work on your phone. So that's one of the things also that we're trying to address that, you know, maybe makes us a little bit different from some of the other NoSQL solutions.
Yeah, so you will run on a Windows phone, even Windows Phone 7. So you're talking about servers or clients or mobile phones. So if I, like for example, I'm working on an application right now that I want to run on a Windows phone, and I want it to run in Windows 8 with a touchscreen, but I might also have a desktop application, I could potentially use Brightstar DB in all of those situations.
Right, that's correct. We've targeted Windows Phone 7. We've targeted PCL builds that enable us to run on Windows 8 and Windows Phone 8 and 8.1. Mm-hmm. We also have the Xamarin flavor of those PCLs.
Oh,
so
really?
So Android and iOS are both on the roadmap. They're not particularly tested yet, and we'd welcome people to come along and try it out and let us know how they get on with Android. But the nice people at Xamarin gave me a development license for working on this stuff, and I'm really keen now to make sure that we can run on those platforms as well. Well,
that's cool. One of the other things that is impressive or surprise, I wouldn't say impressive, I'd say surprising and impressive, was that I was checking out all of the features and looking at this project, and you actually have an entity framework model over this. So how do you deal with the fact that you've got very, very typed, very wishes that it was SQL model in the context of entity framework and a schema-free NoSQL framework underneath it?
Right. Yeah. So the way that we do that is essentially we consider your domain model, so your strongly typed model, as simply being a view onto the data. So when you set up your domain model, and in Brightstar you do it as an interface first, a contract first definition, and then we do some code generation to build you a context. So when you define your domain model, you map that domain model to types and properties in your data model. It's all done by convention. So if you don't want to, you can just write an interface, decorate it with the entity attribute, and that's all you need to do, and Brightstar will take care of the rest. But if you actually want to map it to a particular RDF schema, maybe you want to use some standard schema that somebody else has predefined, then then you can go ahead and do that too. And essentially what we're doing there is when you create an instance of the entity, we will basically, and set properties on it, we'll set some triples in the background to go into a transaction. And when you save changes, we send the transaction with inserts and the deletes that you've made by changing properties on the objects. The other nice thing that we can do when we've done that is that we implement a link provider as well. And the link provider will take your link query across your domain model and actually convert it into a Sparkle query, because Brightstar implements the W3C Sparkle standard, which is a standard query language for RDF. So we convert the link query into a Sparkle query and execute that Sparkle query and then data bind the results back into your domain model. But the really nice thing about doing it in this way is, as I say, your domain model is actually just a view. So it's not really kind of hard-coded into the, it's not tied to the actual shape of the data that you've got in the data store. It's just a partial view of that data. And you can have multiple applications that are all sharing the same data, but actually have different views on the way in which they use the data, you know, way in which they extract the data from the database.
Mm. If, I want to understand more about this strongly typed versus not strongly typed. If I have a person and that person has first name and last name and birthday and then like height, and, you know, that's a very trivial thing. And I could imagine then how you project a strongly typed entity framework thing over that. But then how would I change this schema in the schema free world? Like, let's say these people no longer have height. So, but they do, because some of them are already in the database with height.
Yeah. So, so your application no longer wants to know about height. You simply delete that. That property from your application's interfaces, and then when your application sends updates, because we're because when we're dealing with updates, we're actually not sending an entire state; we're just sending the triples for the properties that you've changed.
Mm.
So when you send the update, you won't be changing the height. And another application that still does care about height will still be able to use that property, set that property, update it in whatever way it wants. So you have that, you know, real flexibility. The data and your model are very loosely coupled.
I see. So in the SQL world, we would just delete that column, and then people who expected it would have their expectations not met, or people who tried to update it would find that that didn't exist. So that interface is broken at the database level. The way that I would kind of implement that in a SQL world would be, say that it was okay to have a nullable date time, and then just don't tell anyone that we're not going to use it anymore, and don't choose to express it to them.
Right, exactly, and in essence, because we're doing this very loose coupling, you have to kind of your application does have to be aware that you may define properties for which there is currently no value, and you'll just get the default unless you define that property as being nullable, in which case you'll get null. So you, when you know there is some application impact that it will have, but it's we think it's a small price to pay for the additional flexibility. I mean, one of the things that I'm really keen on is this idea of applications migrating their data over time. As you go from version one of an application to version two of an application, you get different data requirements. And you always have this problem. I've had it in the past when working with applications based on SQL, is that, you know, version 1.1 introduces a new column, version 1.2 changes some indexing or changes the type of another column. And so you have all of these migration scripts that you have to make sure that you run the right migration scripts in the right order to migrate a customer from version 1 to version 2 via all of the intermediate versions that we've done, or you have to create some monster roll-up of all of the data migration. So you always have this data migration headache alongside the application update headache. And essentially with a store like Brightstar, that goes away, because the data model has no schema that you need to worry about migrating. The data is just there, and you just write your application to deal with the changes that you know are going to happen. So you can kind of take out that whole data migration headache, or at least you can move it into parts of the code where you just need to react to, hey, maybe they don't have a height property because they've just upgraded and that property hasn't been set yet.
Can you see how people would look at this who have been in the industry in the standard kind of, you know, SQL database industry for a while and been working in large enterprises that might say that this all seems just too magical and too dangerous and couldn't possibly work at scale?
Yes. I have conversations with those people. Yes.
How do you work past that?
Well, I think, you know, there are a set of applications for which this kind of magic is, you know, totally not applicable. And it may be that they've got things in mind which, you know, that this data store is not for them. But on the other hand, actually, I would say that rather than being not scalable, the whole thing about having a flexible, open approach to the way in which you're storing and managing your data ultimately makes it more scalable, because it can adapt to a changing environment and to changing requirements much more rapidly than a fixed schema that needs a careful migration plan and a careful data migration plan. So, you know, when your application wants to, for example, if your application is all just a stovepipe application, you know, it's my data, it's my data access layer, it's my presentation layer, and that's it, and that's the whole world that I'm ever going to have, then SQL may well be exactly the right way to go. But if you want an application that is maybe can respond to external data sources, so can merge in data from other sources where you maybe have less control over how those data sources change the way in which they're representing their data over time, or where you just want to be able to start with a core set of functionality and then add some new functionality later on that you have absolutely no idea right now what that is going to look like or how it's going to merge into your data model. You don't have a 5-year plan for your data migration. Then having the flexibility of Brightstar DB and the RDF graph-based data model could really work for you, and it could help you get over some of those data hurdles that you're going to face.
Mm. This seems pretty amazing, and this is all open source, and people can download it right now. There's no licensing issues or anything.
That's right, yeah. So we've chosen the MIT license, so it's totally open. People can use it for commercial, non-commercial applications alike.
Fantastic. This is really cool stuff. People can check this out at brightstardb.com. It's on NuGet. I assume it's up on CodePlex or GitHub. Where do you host?
So we host our source on GitHub. We host our community discussion on CodePlex, and the binary releases are up on CodePlex as well. So all the links are there from the website.
Very cool. Very cool. Thanks for chatting with me today.
No, thank you.
This has been another episode of Hansel Minutes, and we'll see you again next week.